listening to the podcast of Ice and Fire, episode 122 for the week of October 20th, 2013. Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the podcast of Ice and Fire. We are the longest running, somehow award-winning podcast dedicated to George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire series and ancillary novellas and occasionally HBO's Game of Thrones. We have three hosts on tonight's episode, and this is Mimi.
This is Amin.
And this is Kyle.
So the reason why I was thinking through my intro was because I always say, as always, this is Mimi. But I read some criticism from a listener who gets annoyed that I say that because I'm not always on the podcast episodes.
Are you listening to criticism, Mimi? It's so unlike you.
I read some things, and that is a very valid critique, and I don't want to annoy anybody. So I thought about restructuring the way I introduce myself. But yes, it is just the three of us today.
You know how you also restructure the intro? I think you put on your white girl voice.
Did I? Oh, shit.
You totally did that in, like, early Mimi voice.
That's no good. We have to redo it completely. I'm going to have to, like, edit it and drop my voice down a little bit. I get nervous because I haven't done an episode in a little while, so.
It's all right.
Yeah, missed talking with you.
Yeah, it's been a little bit. I'm sorry, every time I'm back on the podcast, it's like, it's always after I've missed 80 episodes.
Yeah, it's like the return of Mimo will be this one, probably.
No, it's not. We're not doing any more podcast episodes titled around my return. I've been pretty busy, and, you know, I guess one major news item that I think a few listeners would probably want us to address is that I finally met another podcast host.
Who?
It was Ashley. We made out. I don't want to talk about it.
Oh my god.
Well, Kyle and I met up in San Diego, and that was fun. I was there on a work conference and just showed up the weekend before for my birthday, and Kyle drove down from LA, so we got to meet each other for the first time, which is really cool when you've been talking to somebody pretty routinely for a few years, to meet up in real life. So yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool. I mean, you weren't my first Mimi. I met Amin before, but
so Amin was your first.
Yes,
but was I better?
in every conceivable way. No, it was really cool. Yeah, I'm glad we finally got to meet. It was like, you know, meeting an old friend. It was really weird. I've never been in that situation before where you've talked to somebody for so many years and then you finally meet up. I felt like I was going to get catfished or something.
You totally did get catfished.
I totally did. Well, as everyone knows, you introduced yourself to me in a robe, so.
Oh. Yeah, and purely circumstantial, but that excited a lot of people, so.
Yes.
Shippers out there.
Well, do tell. What happened, Mimi? You don't want me to explain.
So I guess we posted a picture of ourselves when we first met, and I was in a hotel bathroom, but that's because we just come back from the beach, and it was me and several of my friends staying in the hotel room together, and there's only one bathroom, so they laid stake to it before I could change, and so I just had to put a robe on.
You also had your hands firmly grasped around something, right?
Oh, good Lord. Yeah, the award. It was awesome. It was so awesome to see the award and fuck around with it, take pictures of it. It was really cool. It was cool seeing it in person, you know. It's a beautiful, beautiful little creation, and it was cool. I did not steal it from Kyle, contrary to popular opinion. Respectfully returned it to him. He was kind enough to give one of my best friends a ride back to LA, so I didn't want to, you know, steal from him when he was doing a favor for my
I feel like it's so much dirty innuendo. I mean, come on. No.
But yeah, it was cool. It was just a weird experience. And the weirdest thing is when Kyle and
weird experience.
We spent the entire day together and we did not talk once about Song of Ice and Fire.
It was amazing.
We had no Song of Ice and Fire Game of Thrones discussion at all. I mostly made fun of him for not knowing anything about food, but that's it.
Pretty much. I apparently know nothing about food. I didn't know that you put marbles in soda.
You had a ramune for the first time.
Which I still have in my car and I show to everyone. I'm like, look at this. Is it Japanese?
Yes. It's so weird that you live in such a multicultural city like LA and you're just like, what is this creation? Did you eat those high chews that I got you?
Yeah, I've been munching on them. I'm looking at them right now, actually. And I kind of want to eat one, but then I'll be slobbering all over my microphone.
Good. You see, Kyle and I are best friends already. I buy him candy. I make fun of him.
I know.
The cool thing about it is having talked to him for so long about all of this fantasy novel bullshit. When we met up in real life, it was like basically hanging out with someone that I'd known forever. And it felt like I'd always been sitting in his car mocking him, you know. That was really cool. And he got along with my friends and we didn't do anything remotely podcasty. Sorry, Amin.
But where did you eat?
Yeah, we ate. We ate a lot.
Where? She took me to my very first $1.25 ramen noodle.
Ooh, you upgraded to $1.25 ramen? I thought you were only eating the 25-cent pack.
Well, the $1.25 for like a package of six.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so I stepped out beyond that comfort zone and had my first ever like bowl of ramen with an egg in it and some meat and other random things. Bamboo.
Only annoying thing about meeting up with Kyle is that I have to listen to all of my girlfriends talk about how fine he is for days after. So.
Oh yeah. So how your friends doing? Nah, it was a cool time. It was a lot of fun. I'm glad we finally got to meet, and now I got to get my ass out to Dallas to hang out.
Yeah, open invite. You too, Amin.
Cool.
And you know. I am always jealous that you were Kyle's first, but he said that you were really quick. Kyle and I took it nice and slow. So.
Yeah, Amin was on a mission when I met him. He was like, all right, I'm double parked. We got to get on the train. No. And then he was like, okay, here's this, here's this, here's this. All right, I got to go. Later.
Yeah.
But yes, he was just trying to shove down Korean barbecue and sushi down my throat.
There's always some Asian culture exposure whenever you're meeting up with a podcast. So now we just have to get Ashley squared away and, you know, one of us has to meet her.
There we go.
Well, if we win the podcast awards.
Well, Amin's met her.
Right. She'll come down to Vegas for that.
For the podcast awards? Yes. Yeah. Are we going to... what is this podcast award thingamabob going on, Amin?
Well, we mentioned it before. There was nominations open this month. It's over now, but I think a lot of people nominated us, so thanks.
Find out,
I think, October 28th or 27th, whether we're on the ballot, and then I believe November 1st is when voting opens, but we'll confirm that on our website.
So, yeah, thank you for everyone who submitted a nomination for us. I think we're going to go ahead and start our episode with some relevant information. Do we have any news in the world of Song of Ice and Fire?
There's been some casting, if you want to.
Well, I can tell you guys, before we get into news, I'm going to be on a panel representing this podcast at Kamikaze in a couple weeks, which is an LA convention.
That's awesome.
Kristen and the Geeky, Kristen Nettapack and the Geeky Awards have a panel at Stan Lee's Kamikaze, and she invited me as a award recipient to come and talk on the panel and stuff. So if anybody's going to be in LA Sunday, November 3rd at 2 p.m. in room 303 AB in the LA Convention Center, come check out the Geeky Awards panel and say hello. I'll be there.
Awesome. And to all the girls living in LA, Kyle is apparently very fine, so you should just if you don't like our podcast.
Are you pimping me out, Mimi?
I am pimping you out. It was, yeah, all my friends were like, he's so fine. How have you not hit that? And, you know, it's a weird question, but.
And you were like, well, we just met for the first
yeah,
time.
You know, that internet barrier.
Your boyfriend, wasn't your boyfriend, like, right there, too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. It was a very awkward situation. I walk into the room. Mimi's in a bathrobe. Two of her friends are showering together.
They're not. They weren't. Were they showering together?
Yeah. And then I asked her if she wanted to see it. And I whipped it out. The award, I mean.
Yeah. Cam was very happy about all of this. he was a good sport considering I was meeting Kyle, Mr. Too Fine, Too Furious.
Meeting a strange man in a hotel room in a foreign city.
A foreign city. But yeah, so that sounds awesome. I hope you represent us well. Make sure only to bring your best jokes.
Thank you. I will. I also ordered an extra copy of Flight of Sorrows, which I'll be signing and I believe giving out as a prize to people, to someone lucky in the audience that day. So
nice. Yeah. Also, news from George's blog that I've been looking for updates. For a limited time only, you can buy the first volume of Wild Cards for only $2.99.
Wow.
Until November 1st. So if you've never read Wild Cards, you can get in on it.
Nice.
And then anything else?
What is this? The Three-Eyed Raven cast. I'm literally just looking at Winter is Coming while we're talking here. British actor Strawn Roger has been cast in the role of the Three-Eyed Raven.
Huh.
I think there was a bit of a controversy over people who were potentially spoiled by that or something because of the title.
Mm.
Three-Eyed Raven. So there were some arguments over that. But
so is he Blood Raven?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Or is he just voicing the Raven until, you know, we find Tree Man?
I think he's Blood Raven. I think that they were mad because it said Three-Eyed Crow rather than Blood Raven because Unsullied don't know anything about that. So, like, it's confirming that it's like a person rather than a god or something like that, or some entity.
Yeah, I could see where that could be kind of controversial. Interesting. Huh.
I think they're almost done filming, right? A couple more weeks of filming and then they're done.
I believe so. Yep. What do we have here? Valyrian Steel announces new weapon and armor replicas. We have Jon Snow's long claw, Eddard's ice, Loras Tyrell's helm, and Robb Stark's scabbard. I feel like we've had some of those before.
What strikes me as kind of interesting is that we've been talking about Valyrian Steel since like the beginning of the podcast. Like they were producing their replicas from when we started our podcast. Because I remember I had linked them at one point when we first set up our website. And I was just kind of curious, do you guys think that you would buy like a replica of Valyrian Steel sword?
Holy shit. If I had the extra money, yeah, I'd love one hanging right on my wall.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still waiting for my review copy to be sent to me so I can
review this sword. I'm sure it's necessary.
See if it can take off a head in one swipe. Okay. I got to imagine that their sales have skyrocketed since the show. I mean, it only makes sense. We should get someone from Valyrian Steel on here.
Yeah, I'd be interested in finding out sort of how they go about, you know, the process of crafting these like mythical swords.
That'd be awesome. And where are they stationed? Do we know? If they're in LA or something, I'd love to go with like a cameraman and do like a video segment on that.
This is just fucking Kyle trying to pimp out his YouTube channel somewhere.
you know. Well, now that I know I'm a sexy bitch, aka Mimi and all her friends, I've got to get my face out there more.
Well, yeah. Clearly. hey, I did have a question. This is kind of unrelated, but I don't know, maybe something for listeners to think about too. I've been thinking about getting a tattoo. I'm the only person in my office who doesn't have one, actually. I work in a professional setting, like not at a Hot Topic, but that's how far behind I am, is that I just, you know, I don't have a tattoo. And so I was thinking about things I would do. Would you guys ever get a Song of Ice and Fire related tattoo?
Would I ever get one?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. In fact, I've often thought about when the books finally end and everything kind of comes to a close of getting something. But I don't know what I would get. I'm assuming you're in the same position where you don't know what you would want.
I do.
Oh, you do know?
Sort of, yeah.
Get the Manwoody sigil?
No, I don't know. What about you and me?
I don't think I'd ever get a tattoo, but if I did get one, it probably would be Ice and Fire. But I'm with Kyle. Like, wait till the end of the series so you can figure out for sure if you want that character on there.
I mean, really, what can George do with the last two books that would make you decide that all of your time invested in this fandom was a bust?
I'm sure something could happen. Yeah. I mean, but...
Worst case, he doesn't finish it, you know? Yeah.
Well, I want to know who wins, so then I can decide what sigil to
get. Might make a character or a house turn evil or bad or like change them completely by the end, and you're like, why did I put that on?
Why did I get that huge Martell chest piece? They turned out to be child molesters. All of them. My whole hang-up about A Song of Ice and Fire tattoo is that inevitably it will be entangled with Game of Thrones, which is something I want literally no relation to whatsoever.
Yes.
Don't want to be identified as a fan of that. So I think it's hard to really pin something down. And now I think a lot of people are getting their Game of Thrones related tattoos or whatever because they were turned onto the books or the series from the show. But I think about it, and the thing that always gets me isn't any particular line. It's that, you know, last paragraph of the chapter where Arianne's talking to Doran, and he puts that Saivas piece in her hand and says, you know, justice, vengeance, fire, and blood. Is it that, or is it Vengeance, Justice, Fire, and Blood? I think it's...
Well, I'm not sure off the top of my head.
It's, yeah, so it's Vengeance, Justice, Fire, and Blood.
So that's what you get.
Yeah, but in Mongolian.
Because you just want to go crazy off the wall, just totally unique.
Well, I think it would be a good merging of two things that are important to me. So, yeah. But I definitely decided on my first tattoo, and it's actually going to be a China Medieval-related one. So that... This is not a podcast of Perdido Straight Station, so I should probably continue on. But I guess that the Doran thing sort of ties us into what we were talking about in today's episode, which, to celebrate the fact that the collector's edition of Flight of Sorrows is on sale only in October, we're going to talk about some of our essays in it. And I think this is something we've touched on before, but I think we could go a lot more in depth. I know that we have tangentially discussed my essay, which is available at Tower of the Hand, The Telltale Knight. We've discussed it, I think, tangentially in the Mystery Night episode that we did, but I think Amin, you know, has some points he wanted to discuss, and I'm always down to talk about Dunkin' Egg whenever. And then also we wanted to touch a bit on Amin's addition to the collector's edition of it. You wrote a second one, right? Feast of Vipers?
Yep.
And then Kyle also made a contribution.
Yeah, but we don't need to talk about mine. I did an afterword, which deserves no discussion.
Oh, you had made a couple of good points in there, I think.
I just wrapped it up and said, hey, read these essays. Done. Scene.
All right.
So do you want to go ahead and start with yours while we were talking about Dorn?
Okay, I guess we can. Yeah, we can do that. Sure.
I think that if I, you know, we all have our areas in Song of Ice and Fire that we're obsessed with, and you know, with Amin, obviously, he's particularly adept at talking about history and military strategy. But obviously, from people who've listened to the podcast for several episodes, know that his main focus is Dorne, his favorite region and possibly his favorite subject of discussion.
Yeah. So in this essay, I did a couple of things. I kind of looked at all the mentions of Dorne in the books, and I tried to put them together and try to put a complete picture of Dorne, how they're different from the rest of the kingdoms, what their history has been like, and where they might go in the future. And then I tried to answer certain questions of, like, why is Dorne so popular in the fandom? And then at the end, like, once I'd already finished the essay, some of the controversy came out with the Red Viper casting, so I went back to kind of give my comments in an epilogue at the end of the essay just to talk about why there was some of that controversy and what my view on it was and why there's a diversity of opinions there and why it's fine to have a diversity of opinions there.
So you think Dorne is one of the most popular, like, areas as far as regional areas, as far as the fandom goes?
I think so. I mean, there's still lots of people that don't like Dorne either. In two crews, one group is like Stefan from Boiled Leather, who thinks maybe they're too focused on revenge. And I admit that they have their faults as well. Like, there's a Dornish temper. There is that focus of revenge. And then some other people think they might be overrated militarily, or they think it was just their terrain or their location that helped them be like defeat the Targaryens rather than military might. But I still think that, like, a lot of the fandom, including our podcast, really likes Dorne. So I tried to kind of illustrate that.
So the structure of Dorne geographically is because they're a peninsula, right? So you think that contributed to their ability to resist Targaryen might?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you have the mountains there that separate them. That's a natural dividing point. There's a lot of natural dividing points in Westeros, like, that kind of show where the different Seven Kingdoms were, like the Vale or Dorne or the North. And so theirs is the mountains there. Plus the desert there, which they take advantage of. I don't know if they invented guerrilla tactics, but they seem to have used them very effectively against dragons. And they learned from the mistakes of the other kingdoms, fought dragons in open battle, and avoided that.
Did you just say gorillas versus dragons?
I think that would be pretty one-sided.
I love that Maria Martell says, "This is Dorne. You are not wanted here. Return at your peril." And I think that's a badass thing to say to the conquering Targaryens.
And there's a lot of, like, that history that hasn't been fully revealed yet. We've heard of it from Jorah, but hopefully it'll be revealed further on how they managed to resist for so long against the Targaryens.
I was you know, reading up on the War of the Conquest, and at the time that Maria, you know, I guess kept the Targaryens out of Dorne, she was like 80, right? Apparently she was like 80, fat, blind, bald.
So she had a lot going for her, is what you're saying.
Yeah, she was a babe. And apparently the Storm King called her the Yellow Toad of Dorne, which makes me visualize just Hypno-Toad from Futurama just standing, like, at Sunspear. apparently no one appreciates my Futurama references. But...
Sorry, guys. I keep having a hard time hearing this. There's like a garbage truck doing laps around my neighborhood.
That is a cool story, guys.
Every now and then I may go away because my mic is off because there's a garbage truck racing down my street. But so there's this badass 80-year-old lady who's keeping the Targaryens away. I know so little about this period. Please send me a link so I can research.
Sure.
I don't know what you're doing, Kyle. We're experts. We're Song of Ice and Fire experts.
I mean, I know everything about the history of Dorne. There's Nymeria, and then they didn't bow or bend.
Or break.
Or break. And, blood oranges. Scene. Done.
Well, a lot of the material isn't officially in the books yet. Either George has, like, explained it in response to questions. There was some of the stuff that I cut from the essay. I was on the fence of whether to put it in because it's semi-canon. It's from there was this original RPG book that was released that George, like, helped write. Like, he gave information, like, 2004 around then. And he calls that semi-canon. It hasn't been referred to. Like, for example, according to that book, Dorne does a lot of its trade with the Free Cities and not Westeros. Like, the majority of the trade is with the Free Cities, and they have closer connections there, which you can kind of see. Like, we didn't know anything about trade, but we can see that they still have that connection to the Free Cities. I mean, Doran himself is married to somebody from the Free Cities. It was a marriage of love, but it was acceptable because they have those ties there.
And I feel like Dorne's history has been largely one of alliances being made by marriage as opposed to strength, right? Because, you know, before, Dorne was just sort of like a sort of a loose coalition of like Andals. And the Roynish came, and I believe that there was an alliance between Emeria, right? She married into the Martells.
Mm-hmm. And then that's how the Martells became like the rulers of all of Dorne, because before there was all these little kingdoms there, like the rest of the kingdoms probably had lots of stuff. And again,
when Dorne got brought into the Seven Kingdoms by the Targaryens, it was through a marriage, so to Daeron.
That's actually one of the things that kind of helped spark the rebellion that you cover in your essay a bit, because the king sent his sister down to Dorne, and that sister was Daenerys, and then the guy who started the rebellion actually like loved Daenerys, so that was like one of the factors. Plus the increased Dornish influence in the court. So it all ties together. I think one other thing I covered, I'm curious about what both of you thought, even if you haven't read the full essay, is because I talk about Quentin and how Quentin, like a lot of the fandom was looking forward to Quentin, I think, for many years, waiting for the book. They thought they wanted another Red Viper, and they got the Frog, and there was a lot of disappointment there. But I actually liked
Quentin.
So, I want to see what your views of Quentin were.
You know, I thought that was a huge bummer. Because from Feast for Crows, you know, when Arianne and Doran had that conversation, you were just like, this is going to be awesome. Mm. Like, Quentin is going to go. He's going to meet Dany. Like, good shit's going to happen. And it was a lot of buildup, I think, ostensibly because of the wait between Feast and Dance. I mean, I feel like a lot of the wait in between that really sort of hyped up my expectations of Dorn, you know, and specifically of Quentin. And yeah, I felt really bad. I felt like that whole thing was just like a build up, you know, and no orgasm.
Blue ball central. No, this is where I think I vary a lot from the fandom is I liked it. I like that he was a character that was set up to fail. We had all this. Yeah, we're like, oh, the Dornish, and this is going to be great, and he's going to go over there, and they're going to form this alliance, and things are going to be great, and all that garbage truck is coming around the corner. And and then it just doesn't happen, and he dies, and he fucks it all up, and it's just... I love that. I loved it. I love that it just turns all our expectations on their head. And that's the story. That's why I love reading these books so much, is that the shit he's building up to and we think it's going to be awesome. Oh, it fails miserably. But then it leads to this. Like, it's going to lead to Dorne going even more crazy, because if they're hell-bent on revenge now, oh, my God, you have the prince who's dead and this and that. And it's going to get even crazier. And I love that he was a character that we thought was going to be this amazing thing, and he ended up just being this flop, but it's going to lead somewhere. And I think that that's so cool, and I love that George has the balls to set up a character and set up a people like that and then just completely flip it on its head and yes, piss so many fans off, but the end result is probably going to be freaking awesome because he did. And I love that,
man. You sound like a sadist. Poor Quinn.
Not all the time, just sometimes.
I think Quentin is judged unfairly. I mean, what he did with the dragons was a stupid move. It was brave, but it was stupid. But that was a desperate move. And I feel like a lot of the blame goes on Dany. In some sense, she's basically giving up Westeros for now. She's focusing on the East, and that's her choice. But there wasn't much more Quentin can do. If he was more charming or something, and that's why Dany went with him, that wouldn't look that good on Dany. It's just charm. It's what it takes for her to move and leave her people.
And it's so much pressure for one person, too. You know, his father basically letting him know he can't fail. I mean, feel like Quentin had Asian parents at this point, you know?
He's like, where's your dragon wife award?
Right, high expectations. Fucking Martells, man.
I think there was a breakdown, though, because he spent many years away from his father. Like, I think maybe his father, Doran, might have understood if it failed, and he would have preferred his son coming back alive, but because he didn't even have that connection he was trying to make up for lost time.
Because he was fostered when he was younger.
And it's really sad because I remember, I think, there's just like this younger Ironwood girl who's like, and she's like, just wait for me to grow up. I'm going to like marry you, Quentin. Like she wants to marry him. And now he's dead. Because that would have been a good match later on, maybe. Like a good backup match.
Yeah. And it was one of those things where I feel like Quentin's failure when it came to Dany just really underscored how much I blame Dany for everything in Dance with Dragons, you know? And Barristan had said, you know, she wants fire and Dorne sent her mud. Mud would nourish you where fire would only consume you, but fools and children and young girls would choose fire every time. And it's a valid criticism of Dany's behavior, you know.
But I don't think, if they'd sent fire, she would have left for that. And if she did, that would mean a dumb reason. Just because they sent, like, somebody like the Viper and because he's sexy, then that's the difference.
Well, it was the idea that a Dornish ally would strengthen her cause, but she wants something more glamorous and dangerous and, you know.
Young girl looking for the bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, consorts are possible, right? I think they could have worked something out.
Yeah, I think it was kind of sad, and it was something that had Dany considered, you know, would have really been a good strategic alliance, and obviously Dany not thinking about anything. But that Dario dick.
Yeah. So. No, I think she just focused on that area. Like, she just can't leave. So, like, she said, like, if you had them here, it'd be useful.
But. Like, I get her need to face a challenge in front of her. You know, the idea that if she can't hold this shit together, she's not going to be able to hold the Seven Kingdoms. But, yeah, I mean, I think Dance with Dragons is really when you feel like she loses focus, you know?
There's an interesting blog some people are reading in our fandom right now. It's the Myrnaes Blot. You may want to take a look at that. Like, it may be interesting. He kind of reanalyzes Dany's positions in Dance with Dragons and looks at a lot of the stuff that's deep there.
Is it spent for decisions?
In some and criticizes some, but like it's a good read there. Because a lot of time we're focused still doing our Clash of Kings reread and we're doing that. But Dance with Dragons still has a lot of things in there that are worth looking at. Like, people have pulled things out of it, just like they did with Feast for Crows over the years.
Sure. Yeah. Do you think another reason why readers like Dorne so much is because of the cultural differences? And the banging?
Yeah. if you compare it to the rest of Westeros, like, for some people, first of all, it's just easier to read when it's, like, more liberal or women have more rights there, right? There's actually female leaders. There's a couple of ladies in power if you look even at the appendix.
Yeah,
But it's just interesting, too. You can see, like, how they bend the usual traditions there with Kingsguard having paramours and that kind of thing, and it's acceptable.
And obviously the parallel between Dorne, you know, when we're talking about the parallels with Westeros, you know, being more European and Dorne being what, like Middle Eastern, medieval Spain.
I always said the spectrum was from India to Southern Europe. Like, it's all along that, and there's people there from all along that spectrum. And I'm still going to stick with that. That's like the interpretation I'm going to go with. So.
You want Dr. Bashir as Dorne Martell.
Yeah, I retweeted that. I think that would be good. Have you seen that one, Mimi, that actor?
Mm-mm.
Let me send you that.
Nope. But I did think it was interesting when they talked about the ethnic mix, you know, of the Dornish, which is something they don't really get into in any other region.
Yeah, well, it was a big mix because you had the original things. And then when Nymeria came over, I mean, that was a completely different race joining in.
Mm-hmm.
And just what spawns from that. So who knows?
And I cover that as well. Like, I show that that hasn't been a huge, like, it could be an issue in some areas, but it hasn't gone there. He hasn't put, like, Ironwood fighting Martell because they're different looking. That doesn't seem to be it. It's just a play for power and the historical control over Dorne rather than being like, some racial element there within Dorne. Outside of Dorne, there seems to be there. There's even Joffrey and others have made comments like that, but not within Dorne.
Well, the Dorners are too busy fighting the Reach, so
yeah.
Historically.
I'll send you a link for Alexander Siddig. That'd be good.
Gotcha. So, so were there some points that you didn't make in your essay that you wanted to discuss?
Just what I was talking about, like there's some semi-canon about how they're even more connected to the Free Cities than I thought. Like the trade is really big there. So that's what I wanted to mention. And just, yeah, other than that, no, not really. Like we can see what the feedback is. If there's any other questions related to it, I can go into.
Kyle, why are you breathing so heavy?
Am I?
Yeah.
He's looking at the Alexander Siddig pictures right now. So.
Let me move this away from, is that better?
Now it's the birds.
Shit, I'm sorry. I guess my mic's just up.
Got too many little birds. Kyle's got under his employ.
Well, this is a good time to do it because the birds come at like dusk and dawn, kind of ish. So there's just a couple right now.
Mm. Cool. Do we want to move on to Mimi's essay then?
Yeah, I did want to point out the footnote for 13.
Oh, sorry.
When you say, I own part of Ice and Fire.
Sorry, I didn't hear that. Kyle was doing something in the background.
I was scaring the birds away, all right?
Oh, I was just laughing at the footnote number 13 in your essay when it says, I own the Art of Ice and Fire volumes 1 and 2, as well as the Game of Thrones board and card games. And I read that and I was like, you don't have ownership of those things. I mean, what are you saying?
I have a stock in them, though.
That's how I read it. And I was like, I don't think that's right. Yeah. But I guess you're trying to say that you have copies of them. And that's what you're referencing.
Well, that was in the epilogue when I was talking about like the debate over where the Martells or just Dorne in general falls.
Mm-hmm.
In people's spectrum. And I was just saying a lot of the officially licensed material, there's a lot of characters there that would easily be from the Middle East or North Africa. Like, you just look at them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's odd that, I mean, like, and then they only cast 1 or 2 people, and half their castings have been from that area. So that's fine. But it was just odd that some people in the fandom were saying, like, no, like, nobody would be from that area. And we'll look at their officially licensed thing. Why were they licensing them? Well, why was it not an issue then?
Right. Gotcha. Yeah, there's been a bit of debate about skin color, but it's kind of inevitable anytime that you are casting someone that doesn't maybe a different racial mix than you would really want from you would expect from canon, right? So
the fact that people were getting so crazy about one casting, I thought, yeah, it was an overreaction. Let's let him do his thing.
Man, I was just so heartbroken about the Dothraki that I stopped caring about anything else. So until I see Asians in Game of Thrones, I'll never agree with any of their casting. Anyway, I guess, yeah, I mean, you wanted to move on to my essay, The Telltale Knight.
Yeah, let's do that. I really enjoyed your essay, Mimi, and I'll repeat kind of what we were talking about in the pre-show or after-show. In some ways, it was like lots of your, I could see it was you because you were even swearing at it. Like, it was just like Mimi chat. It's good. And then some areas I was like, was she just carrying her in her pocket thesaurus and just pulling things from it? Like, it was like, it was really.
Oh, wow.
Whoa.
Okay. What a bash.
It's not a horrible criticism, but it was just like
Zingbot.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the things that I think I had addressed with you guys, or that I addressed before in the forums, is that, or maybe even the last time that we talked about the essay, is that I, you know, my entire education, undergrad and grad school, that I write academically, so that's the style that I'm used to writing in. So my essay doesn't particularly sound like my speech pattern, but no thesaurus was consulted. Clearly because I misspelled hordes.
How could you?
I think they're fixing that though for the ebook. Like the editor's updating that. So.
Oh, for the published book?
Both. For the published book and for the ebook. Like if people who like update via Kindle, it'll update that and remove that mistake.
Oh, okay. Good.
Which is kind of sad because you lose that bit of history there. So.
History of me, obviously. English not being my first language.
But I mean, there kind of aside, there is an argument even for academic writing to keep it simpler than like complex. There's two views on that, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that in science, you keep it complex so that no one understands what you're talking about, and your thesis sounds a lot smarter than it actually is. So.
Yep.
Yeah. I learned that whenever I tell anyone the title of what my senior thesis was, they're just like, I don't want you to talk about that anymore. So.
Just like, good. Perfect. Just like keep the grant money flowing and let us do our thing. So.
Wow.
So
give me a lowdown of what your essay is about, Mimi.
Sure. Essentially, Tales of Duncan Egg, as always. A mean thing is Dorne, And mine thing is Dunkin' Egg. I mean, those novellas, I extol their virtues on almost every podcast episode we talk about that brings up Dunkin' Egg. You know, we've done the three episodes. We've done the Hedge Knight, Sworn Sword, and the Mystery Knight episodes. And I've, you know, covered these novellas pretty effusively and in great detail. I think those are some of our longest review episodes, too, because a lot of it is just trying to, you know, me trying to convince Kyle that characters are actually gay. But yeah, when we were doing our Mystery Night episode, it was like going on forever because we were going through like every fucking line of the novella. But that's how much I love them. I just think that they're such good pieces of fiction. So in this, I kind of, you know, discuss Dunkin' Egg. I mean, I started out summarizing all three of them, and then I realized it was just like filler bullshit. There was no reason for me to summarize the novellas because my assumption is if you read the Telltale Knight essay that you've read the novellas already, so there's no reason for me to recap them. That, and it was taking for fucking ever. So
I noticed that when I was just reading it, I was like, oh, this is just recapping what happened. I can skip this paragraph.
No, I mean, I took it out and then I just sort of talk about the characters, you know, Dunk and Egg, ostensibly, kind of talk about, you know, sort of their character arcs and how they grow and how they complement each other. And then really just the way that the Dunk and Egg novellas tie in to all of the, you know, Song of Ice and Fire canon that we get from the novels proper and how that, you know, it's not even so much as direct backstory filling in these like threads and loose ends and these questions that develop over the course of reading, you know, the five books, but it's more of like a texturization of Westerosi history. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, kind of draw some conclusions, maybe some foreshadowing that Martin does. And then we talk a little bit about Summerhall and what I think might've happened there. So yeah, essentially that's my essay in a nutshell.
Nice. Cause you start to draw parallels between what has happened and what will happen and sort of helping to foreshadow what's coming in the main books. Do you think by the end of the series and by the end of the Dunkin' Egg novellas that the Dunkin' Egg novellas will be necessary in order to get the full picture?
I think so. I think there are things that Martin won't go into that he'll touch on in the novellas as long as he continues to write them, you know? I don't think there's going to be any amount of exposition or reminiscence about old events that would really shed the same light that reading the Dunkin' Egg books would. And I think that we'll get to Summerhall by the end of the novellas, you know?
Gotcha. But they won't be necessary. They'll just be wonderfully additive and able to flesh out the story, but not necessary.
Yeah, I don't think they would be. I mean, I think George could really capitalize on selling his anthologies if he made that an integral part of the Song of Ice and Fire experience. I mean, in and of themselves, I think that Tales of Dunkin' Egg are integral to the Song of Ice and Fire experience. I really think they are, but I don't think that, you know, to write a successful series of novels, you need to have your, you know, readers reference a short story from several hundred years ago to be able to fill in some gaps, you know? But yeah, I think it makes the whole thing, it makes the history feel big and it makes it feel rich. And putting us in it makes it feel very much, I hate to say this, but it makes it feel more real, which is an odd term when I'm talking about fiction, colluding with fiction.
This is real. This is real life.
But yeah, there is something about the mythos of Westeros, right? The way they talk about history that you know, our characters in the present day Westeros, regard as legendary or, you know, long dead history. And there is something to be being in that moment when you read a Dunkin' Egg novella, when you're there, you know, at the, you know, the second failed Blackfyre Rebellion or whatever, that really sort of brings it all to life. So I really like that. And also like the way that, I think the Dunkin' Egg novellas bring us face to face with the Targaryens. I think that's one of the most important things that they do.
Yeah. And I think, like, of all the essays in The Flight of Sorrows, I'm glad this is the one that is freely available on the web, because I think it's one of the must-reads, like, particularly if you've read Dunkin' Egg, or if you haven't, it doesn't really spoil that much. Like, I would still go read Dunkin' Eggs and then come and read this. But there's a lot of points in here that I think are really relevant. People may agree or disagree, but it's definitely on a must-read, I think, for people getting serious about the series. So I had a couple of points I can make if we're ready to go into that.
Okay.
I thought one point you made that was really interesting was you were talking about how The books are very gray, but for a lot of Duncan Egg, it's more black and white. Like, we're cheering Duncan Egg going through the story. I mean, there is some gray there with, for example, Sir Eustace in the second story, but it is a nice distinction there, right?
Did I make that point?
Yeah.
It's a good point. So
every paragraph you have a good point here, so it's pretty good.
Yeah, that is something that I noticed. And I think I mentioned this before in the Mystery Night episode, but it is weird when you read the pacing of a Dunk and Egg novella. It's very clearly that Dunk is the protagonist and you support him and you support Egg. And with Dunk's particular perspective too, being able to see things only through his eyes, and maybe with Dunk being a little less intellectual or less perceptive than other characters would be. You know, because he constantly reinforces the fact that he's simple, although he's really not stupid. He may be just a little slower, you know? And I think that the way that he looks at things is interesting because you as a reader are exposed to it. And it seems very clear to you from Dunk's perspective who is a fucking asshole and who is not. So it's kind of interesting in that respect. I don't know that there is any character that is 100%, you know, in Song of Ice and Fire, in the novels proper, that's 100% just good, just an amazingly good person. I think that, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot his name. Oh, shit.
What did he do?
The Onion Knight?
Davos.
I'm sorry, I totally blanked. Yeah. Yeah, I think Davos comes close. I think certain characters come close, but never in the same sort of like endearing, humble, chivalrous way that Dunk does.
Now, do you think in one of the future like stories, he might actually make like a bad mistake or do something like that'll make that gray?
I think so. I think that that's entirely plausible. We have talked about the possibility that Dunk, you know, has offspring, which is something as a Knight of the Kingsguard he's not supposed to do, right?
True, but he doesn't become that for a while.
Become that for a while, so he could have totally fathered some kid, but it would be an interesting break in his like adherence to knighthood if that was something he was faced with. And I think Dunk's character, if he has any weakness, any sort of dent in his arm, it would probably be for love, you know?
It would be interesting if he did father like a child afterwards, but like Egg was like, oh, whatever, we'll forget about it. So like bending the rules just for his friend.
I feel like Egg probably would. Egg is much more of a target. I mean, he's a little less, you know, goody two shoes than Dunk. He's quick witted and brash, but he's still incredibly likable, you know, because he's young and he is learning. And I think the interesting thing about watching the progression of Dunk and Egg is that you have a very real idea of how Egg could have turned out had he not traveled with Dunk, had he not been exposed to the small folk and the important lessons of knighthood that Dunk teaches him. I think that there is this real possibility that you could see him end up very much in the madness clutches of Targaryen lineage.
Certainly. I mean, surrounded by his crazy brothers. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he totally knew Arian was an asshole when he was little, so I don't think he would have ended up that crazy, but he might not have been as effective of a ruler. And you can definitely see that at the beginning when he's really haughty and, you know, he's got these Targaryen opinions, and being humbled through his journey really, you know, really changes that. But there is that moment where you realize where he has these bits of Targaryen moments, especially in the Mystery Night too, where he has his sort of his dragon moments where you could see how he could have become a different person and that Dunk was absolutely important to his development as a ruler.
Nurture over nature.
Yeah, exactly.
And you point out you get the point of view of the lower classes and you see how they're and like one of the complaints about the books is that there isn't a lot of lower class POVs. Like there's Davos, you see stuff through Arya, but you get Dunk here as well.
Which is nice. And I think that Martin addresses that with Brienne's travels a little bit, you know, hers were kind of truncated, but I think that he does a little bit of that. And Brienne and Pod, as we've talked about before, their travels very much mirror Dunk and Egg, you know?
Mm. Yeah, you make that comparison and you say maybe Podrick Payne is going to go far. We got to remember that Tyrion likes Podrick Payne too. So if Tyrion gets into power, Pod could
get it. So. But, you know, after Martin's antics, I wouldn't be surprised if Pod is a character that you think might have some potential and he just dies horribly.
Yeah. I don't think Pod, yeah. I think Pod's got a
He's one of the characters he could future. Kill off quite easily if he wanted to. Yeah.
Yeah, there's certainly no reason to do anything particularly out there with Pod, although if he did, I'm sure the fandom would love it. Because, you know, Pod's an endearing character, but if we're talking about the sort of gritty reality that Martin does, Pod's probably going to die a horrible death.
Yep, that's what I see.
The same. I'm going to quote a couple of your lines here that are good. Like, you do a lot of character comparisons, so that here's one quote. The stark parallel between Viserys and Arion, especially, is a notable correlation that leads to horrific deaths across the Narrow Sea for both, wrought purely by hubris. You make a nice connection there between those two characters. And then Brienne and Dunk. It is likely that both characters suffering from a feeling of awkward displacement in their societies turn to the code of knighthood to carve out a space for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is the most stark parallel between Brienne and Dunk, is that they're both the knightliest bitches in their day, and neither of them are actually knights. So it's a good thing that George does. And I think he did it for a particular reason and not because he wants to echo a trope, you know?
Cool. And one final comment then is when you were talking about dreams and how they can be misinterpreted, and you talk about Summerhall, and you were talking about maybe how Rhaegar might have been the dragon born there. And I thought that was pretty interesting, especially maybe Summerhall was a sacrifice needed for that.
Yeah, I think that that is a trademark of the Targaryens, is having these dragon dreams and totally misinterpreting them. I think that they consistently do that, right? I mean, we came across that in the Hedge Knight at the very beginning, when I believe it was Daeron, Egg's brother, the drunk, you know, who dreams of Dunk and a dead dragon. You know, and I think the Targaryens are aware that when they have these dragon dreams, that the dragon symbolizes a Targaryen, but they never seem to get it right. So Daeron, you know, was worried that the dragon was himself, and he, like, did not want to fuck with Dunk in that respect. And, of course, it turned out to be Baelor, Breakspear. And then, you know, in Mystery Knight, Daemon Blackfyre tells Dunk he dreamed of, you know, the castle that they were at, the Pale White Castle, Dunk and a dragon bursting from an egg. And, you know, he misinterpreted the dragon to be a literal one, which I think is kind of stupid, considering that in these dreams it's always sort of prophesized that, you know, the dragon represents a Targaryen. But, yeah, I think that he misread that in some ways, and clearly the dragon in that premonition, well, as Bloodraven presents it, is symbolic of Egg coming into his own as a Targaryen prince. So a dragon bursting from an egg. I mean, I couldn't get any clearer than that, right? And so then when it came to Summerhall, that is an interesting setup to what happened at Summerhall, because the details of it are obviously very hazy, and Summerhall is just sort of hailed as this great tragic event that people know about, but nobody ever just comes out and just says this is what happened at Summerhall. It's only referenced, you know.
Why is that?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
Why are people so afraid to talk about what happened there?
Probably because it's fucking horrible.
I think George is being coy. Like, he makes references like that, but instead of just showing it right away, maybe he's saving it for the Hedge Knight to show exactly what happens. But
yeah, and also that could be a pretty common way that people talk about tragedy, that tragedy that everybody knows about, right? Like historical tragedy. Even now in our current, like, modern world, I'm sure that when we talk about things that have happened, we're like, so, you know, like on September 11th, when this exact thing happened, you know, like it's always done referentially because everyone understands what happened at Summerhall.
It can be very clunky if you have somebody just like say what happened when everybody already knows, just kind of like breaks the reading when that happens.
But, you know, I think that there have been enough comments that give us an idea, with Alistair Florent saying, you know, did we learn nothing from Summerhall? No good has ever come from these dreams of dragons. And that's another question that this brings up, is that these dragon dreams that the Targaryens have, are they always premonitions of tragedy?
Well, Rhaegar has his dreams, or at least he had something when he was thinking about there's going to be dragon has three heads idea.
Yeah, so that's another example of the dragon dream.
He thought Aegon was going to be there, but I don't think anybody believes Aegon is the actual Aegon, do they?
Right. Well, that's a big question there.
Are there never good dragon dreams?
Well, I guess the one that Daemon Blackfyre had with the dragon bursting from an egg, you know? But that in and of itself was not a good dragon dream for him. That was the end of his proposed rebellion, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, but he's not killed. He's just going to be kept as like a rich hostage.
Yeah, but that fucking sucks.
Who he hangs out with, but he meets like one of the Renlys of his times. So he'd be good.
Yeah. But it's interesting if Aegs, you know, ascent to Targaryen, you know, to the Targaryen kingdom, to ruling, came from a dragon dream, and his death came from a dragon dream as well.
Hmm.
And I guess there's something quite poetic about that. So,
here's another question. Do you think there might have been sabotage at Summerhall? Like, how the heck does a whole freaking castle burn down? Is it like wildfire or just accident?
Well, you're saying how does a whole castle burn down?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, there's two things.
Like, do you not remember Harrenhal? Like,
yeah, but they didn't have dragons to do that then, right? Like, they had dragons that burned down Harrenhal. Like, I guess either they had wildfire that somehow, like, got out of hand and did it. Like, that's one thing. How did that happen? But second is, like, well, maybe, like, somebody sabotaged it. Maybe the maesters didn't want the dragons to come back. Like, this that popped into my head when I was reading this.
The maesters sabotaged it?
Maybe.
The Black Candle.
Yeah, I mean, we knew it was a fire, and we knew it came from an attempt to hatch a dragon egg, so...
It's just such a mystery.
It's like those
guys.
What are we
going to figure out? Do you guys think we'll figure it out in the main books, or do you guys think we'll figure it out in the Duncan Egg novellas? The whole Summerhall.
I mean, I hope we figure it out from the Duncan Egg novellas, but the only way to do that is if George actually fucking writes it, you know?
I think he can pump them out, though. As you point out, he's a really good short story writer. If he was done with a series, he could sit down and just pump out short stories in this area.
I mean, I like the idea that whenever he's tired of working on the book, he just writes another Duncan Egg novella. But, yeah, I mean, he would have to tell us. I mean, I think at the very least, we're going to get the dragon dream that led them to doing what they did at Summerhall, to trying to hatch a dragon. They're gonna have, I mean, I think that he's at least going to write the dream that prompted it. Because, I mean, this is a hypothesis, of course. I don't know that there was a dream or prophecy, but I think that, you know, what's pretty likely is that the disastrous attempt to hatch a dragon egg at Summerhall came from the product of a misread dream.
They should have done it. Go ahead.
I think that obviously the dragon that was born at Summerhall or whatever, the dragon that the dream, you know, foreshadowed was, again, a Targaryen. It was Rhaegar. Rhaegar was born that day. And I think that maybe was misread. But I don't know. I mean, it might or might not be the case. I think that based on the precedence of all the dragon dreams that have been, you know, highlighted in the other novellas, it might be pretty plausible. And it would explain Rhaegar's birth on the same day that his predecessors are trying to raise a dragon. And then also the connection that he bears to Summerhall that's like haunted him his whole life. How melancholy he felt about it, how much time he spent there.
Now, I know with Thanksgiving coming up for you guys, like a lot of people, they've been frying their turkeys now. And apparently, like if you fry your turkey indoors, like there's a lot of fires that come from that. Like you knock the pot over and it burns the house down. So maybe the kind of same thing. They were trying to like dip the eggs in giant wildfire pot. They dipped it, and they should have done it outside, but they did it inside, and then they burned the castle down.
I hope that it is more poetic than that.
Dunk was just really hungry and wanted a fried turkey.
No, I mean, like, that's the egg. They put the egg, they dip the eggs in wildfire to kind of, like, get them.
It's interesting that you think it's wildfire. I would have assumed someone would have said something about that. And more to the point, the fact that that old crone survived the fire. If it was wildfire, nobody would have survived that shit.
Well, how could it just be regular fire that killed everybody or burned the place down? I don't know. Unless, like, they brought a dragon and it went crazy and it burned and then it died by itself. But that wouldn't work either. It'd be a baby. So, like, how could they all die? Like, what happened? Was it an explosion?
Fires kill people. I mean, fires are pretty effective.
Yeah, but, like, to burn a castle, like, you could just, like, go to the back of the castle, like, I don't know, isn't it all stone?
Fire leaves an escape route.
It was just made out of, like, fucking silk.
Maybe they died from the gas, like, the poison gas or the, like, from the smoke.
Or the fire just happened so quickly they couldn't get out.
Yeah.
I think they used wildfire. I think wildfire was involved.
There we go. I have no theories. Shit got hot.
Got hot.
Let us know what you think out there. If we can try to, listeners, let us know. Imagine what happened there.
So tell us about the Blood Raven linkage between the Duncan Egg novellas, Mimi. You're big on this one.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I really need to specify the linkage. Blood Raven is fucking in the Dunkin' Egg novellas and it's awesome. And that's, you know, I have talked about this time and time again, I know, but that's the joy of reading Dance with Dragons when you've read the Dunkin' Egg novellas and you know, like, what's up with Blood Raven. They talk about him referentially in the novels. They sort of discuss him in passing and you don't really get the full weight of Blood Raven's role in the Targaryen lineage. You don't really get the fear that preceded his, you know, reputation. But you definitely get it when you read the Dunkin' Egg novellas, because it's the whole climate of fear that Blood Raven in charge fosters, you know? And so the direct exposition of his character in the short stories is minimal. It really, you know, you only actually just see him for real in Mystery Night. It's really cool that you hear him talked about as much and gossiped about, and you see people put to death, you know, for speaking out against him. I mean, his name, I point out, becomes synonymous with a whispered curse among the small folk, because they question his reach as King's Hand. They question his motives. You know, he's a target of suspicion because of his, like, entanglement with sorcery. And he's just, like, the celebrity that exists in Westeros at that time. And you don't get that in the books. You don't get the weight of it. So when Bran finally meets him, you're like, oh, there's a dude in a tree. But when you read the novellas, you're like, holy shit, it's Blood Raven, you know? So that's a cool feeling.
Yeah, I know
I've talked about that before, but that's something that I particularly enjoyed in the novellas.
I remember when Dance came out and he contacted me and like, hey, have you got to that Bran chapter yet? And I was like, oh, not yet. And then I read it and I guess I don't pay enough attention to how people look in the books. Mm-hmm. Just not superficial like you, Mimi. So, and I was like, oh yeah, that chapter was great when Bran warged into Hodor and fought a bunch of monsters. And you were like, what are you talking about? That's not at all what I mean. I was like, oh, what'd you mean? She goes, Blood Raven? I'm like, yeah, that was... And then I quickly reread it, and I was like, oh, that guy. Okay, I got it.
Blood Raven is just like, he's fucking awesome.
Yeah, he's a scary dude. Scary dude. Do you think that... because now that he's linked up with the tree and everything, and you've got that whole time travel aspect that goes with the trees. I can't believe I just said that talking about this book. But do you think the Blood Raven of old, back in the Dunkin' Egg time, has any sort of realization about what's going on with his future self? Like, is there any connection between the two?
Well, I'll say this, like, I don't know who said it. Somebody had said that maybe Blood Raven engineered his own downfall. I was trying to think, like, why he would do that, unless if that is true, then maybe he had, like, a vision of the future that it was necessary for him to be there at the wall.
Necessary for him to get up there. Yeah.
It's a very, like, hero's take.
Maybe he just grasped too far and then he fell down.
Well, I mean, I don't think that his fall was that extensive. I mean, he was like an honor guard, you know, accompanying Aemon to the wall. Prisoner, but an honor guard or whatever. And then he became Lord Commander, so, you know.
Yeah, he was pretty badass. I mean, he had a pretty badass life. And he was with Shira Seastar. Like, come on. Like, I'll just send you the link, but...
Shira Seastar is one smoking hot lady.
That's one of the reasons. Yes. I think Bittersteel was with her too. I think they were fighting over her or something. Was it Bittersteel? Let's see.
Blood Raven and Bittersteel were battling over her because Blood Raven loved her, and there were rumors that Bittersteel desired her as well. So just the hatred grew, the jealous hatred between the two, between Bittersteel and Blood Raven. Over a lady. Who'd have thunk?
And do you think Shira is still around, maybe?
Ew. Sorry, I was just thinking about how...
Well, she bathes in blood, right, to keep her beauty?
Yeah, that's probably actually Dany.
It's funny because actually the picture that they have of her on the wiki kind of looks like Emilia Clarke a little bit. Dun, dun, dun. Rumors.
Before the fifth book, like, now that we see that the people can be kept alive, like, through special means... Well, maybe somebody else can be kept alive through special means as well from that period.
Yeah, I don't think she actually bathed in blood.
This egg's like imagination, the rumors.
Yeah, like, again, it comes down to all the things that people say about Targaryens, right? All the rumors that are, they are really just like the celebrities of Westeros. People say a lot of shit about them. But the Duncan Egg novellas really expose you to the realities of the situation. And I think one of the most telling moments is when, you know, after Baelor Breakspear dies, I think that that was a really interesting moment because Maekar says, like, I know what's going to happen. Everyone's going to say that I meant to kill my brother. Like, I'm going to hear the whispers till the day I die that I'm a kinslayer, you know? Mm-hmm. And he realizes how these rumors get started and how those rumors get written as history over time. And I think that's what happens with the Targaryens. And we get exposed to that, you know, years down the line in the Song of Ice and Fire novels. We hear about all this crazy shit the Targaryens got up to or the things that they did. But the reality of the situation is very different when you're in that moment. And we know that Maekar killed Baelor accidentally. Mm.
So but you want to shift into Kyle's thing once we're done with this?
Yeah, no, I guess the one thing I wanted to say was that it suits history better. It suits the sort of the colorization of history to say that this person can slay this person to take the throne, right?
Well, and you said yourself that, like, when we start reading the books, we get all anti-Targaryen, at least from one angle, from what we hear. And then this book shows, like, some of the good that the Targaryens did.
Yeah, definitely. The first thing that we see, you know, is Robert's rage against Rhaegar Targaryen. And that was a very interesting juxtaposition because that's what we get for, you know, just a little bit. We get this idea even from the first chapter with Robert's feud that Rhaegar was this horrible person who raped his fiance or whatever. And then we meet Dany, and over the course of the story, we get a different story about Rhaegar. So it's just that the polarization of these Targaryens that become larger than life. And they've been these historical figureheads for insanity and power, but you actually meet them and you know that there are some like Arion who were just totally fucking mental. You do Targaryens like Baelor, you know? So they really run the gamut. And I think that history tends to polarize the Targaryens.
Yeah. It's, you know, history's written in the eyes of the victor, right? But it makes me think this, somebody told me this, you guys are going to hate this reference, but what you just said reminds me of, do you guys know that they keep records of every single tweet ever made from Twitter? They have a database somewhere, every single tweet ever made. And I can only imagine if, like, our society has a downfall or whatnot, or we get invaded by aliens or some shit like that, and they collect this record, and, like, 50% of the tweets ever are about Justin Bieber. And how he would be considered like this godlike being if some other race would take over our society because of all these people that just say how amazing he is or how what he's done. And I can't believe this. He's so beautiful. He's this and that and that. And if you take an outside source and bring it in and all they're reading are those observations of the fans and everything, how you have this completely skewed view of someone. And I feel like a lot of that's with the Targaryens, where they just had word of mouth and they were like, oh, they're so beautiful and they do this and they do that. And that's all you know of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I think Dany is a Targaryen that really sort of is our connection to the idea that Targaryens can be great and they can also be severely flawed. You know, they can be a shade of gray. And I think Dany is a great character. She doesn't seem like that from the first couple of books, especially the first three books where Martin is, you know, pumping her up as a protagonist. But I mean, certainly even by book three, some of her hubris, you know, really becomes evident. Mm. And definitely by book five. So you see a lot of, you know, her kind regard for the less fortunate population of Slaver's Bay. You see that kindness in her. And then on the other hand, you see that there is a haughtiness, an entitlement to her personality. And there are moments when she says things or does things and brings out the Targaryen anger that, you know, reminds you of Viserys and Arion. Mm. So.
The blood runs hot.
Exactly. Anyway, so, Amin, you wanted to move on?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump into Kyle's afterward because I think it's relevant.
I want to talk about his afterward.
What, okay. What I summarize it as is what Kyle, I think what you're saying is it's the best of times and it's the worst of times right now, right?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. That certainly fits. I don't know. Yeah, I guess you could do that. Worst of times, I don't know if I completely agree with that side of it, but yeah, it's the best of times.
Well, I mean, like, you have to wait. We're waiting for the books, so you got to wait for the books. But while you wait for the books is the time where you can get into theorizing and comparing things, not just for the main series, but with Duncan Egg, right? You can look between them and do stuff Absolutely. That you couldn't do if it was done.
Exactly. This is so much. I mean, obviously, we're the prime example of that. There's so much to do and so much to talk about while we're waiting for each book. And so instead of just becoming angry because you want the next one and you want that those immediate answers and those immediate results, it's like just sit back and discuss and have fun. And I know we've been talking about it for so long, but I feel like there's still stuff, like you guys were mentioning stuff today about the history of Dorne. And I'm like, oh, shit, I don't know enough about that. Now I kind of want to go look it up and learn more about it. And then when the next book does eventually come out, like, I'll have such a better grasp and a better understanding, and I'll be able to enjoy it more. And there's just so much to do while we're waiting. And I just don't understand the hatred, the pure, like, the anger of get that next one out immediately, George. What the hell are you doing? Like, I think it's a great time to just enjoy the ride.
I think I've actually learned more about Song of Ice and Fire being part of the fandom than I have from actually reading the books.
Yes.
There's only so much you pick up reading the books, even if you've read them a million times and at the pace of one chapter a year, like we have with the rereads. But the stuff that the sheer amount of things that I learn from, you know, from even just podcasting, not just sitting there reading Tower of the Hand, like I do while podcasting, even that alone. Yeah, absolutely. There's so much to be learned from being participatory and being vocal in the fandom. Mm. I think about that now because I'm reading Harry Potter to Cam, and we are over halfway through with the sixth book, so we're almost done. And he's sitting there musing about whether Severus Snape can be trusted or not. And it's hilarious to me that he has all these questions and all these conversations about Harry Potter now when the dialogue is ended, you know? And I think that the best time to be a fan, you're absolutely right, is in the middle of this anticipation. It's being here before anything is done, before anything is finalized.
And even like we were talking about Bloodraven, for example, like some people did predict that he was going to show up just from reading the Mystery Knight and reading the books. So it wasn't a surprise. That was a capability you had otherwise. But if you're reading them just like one go in the future, you're not really going to be looking for things like that. You're just going to read.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense of satisfaction when something happens the way you think it will. And then there's this immediate emotional reaction when something happens the opposite of how you think it will.
Which is wonderful.
Martell. yeah, but no, it's something, though. You know, the feeling of being punched in the stomach. Like when you're like, I've been daydreaming about the Quentin Dainey wedding for several years. He succumbed to what? Like, you know. Yeah, there's a big emotional weight of it too, which makes it that much more fun. So
nice.
And I think it was from Feast for Crows when it first came out. There was the kind of a like a letdown compared to Storm of Swords, but then over the years, people reread Feast for Crows, pulled so many theories out, discussions, and like got a lot out of it. And I think the same thing has kind of happened with Dance of Dragons. There was a bit of a letdown.
Say Dance came out and made Feast look like a masterpiece. Why was I complaining about Feast? It was so good. I think it's, you know, Winds is going to come out and do stuff people aren't happy with, and they're just going to like go back to Dance.
Well, I think Winds is going to be a jump up even from the exit. Like reading it is going to be a higher point, I think. Like especially the first couple hundred pages, it's going to have so much jammed in there, right? So many battles and stuff going on. But like two things about Dance of Dragons. One's like people are rereading and getting more out of it, and now they're putting it together with Feast into a single book. So like trying to like get more out of the book now, a couple years later.
Could be.
So as we were just discussing, I just found was flipping through my Facebook and an article. Somebody posted, says HBO announces Game of Thrones not coming back this weekend.
What?
It's an Onion article about how Game of Thrones will not be on this weekend or next weekend, but it will eventually be.
Doesn't it keep like shifting back a week, like every year? Like when is it now? Is it like March something? Which is good. But I think we pretty much covered a lot of stuff this episode. I'm pretty happy.
Awesome. We made no stupid jokes. I think we did. I think we did an excellent summary of our contributions. And then I guess if you guys are interested in Amin's essays, we also cover the first essay he did for the original edition in an earlier podcast episode that I can't remember.
I think it was 80, late 80s, something like that.
It's been a long time. We've cranked out quite a few recently, so in the past year or so. But anyway, yeah, so the collector's edition only available at the time that this is going to be published, probably for 2 more hours. So right before November 1st, I'm going to get this out. But I think there's some great essays in there. So if you guys are interested in that, if you guys aren't interested in that, totally cool. Still read the Dunkin' Egg novellas, please, at this point, if you're listening to the 122nd podcast episode of me swooning about Dunkin' Egg. Definitely read those, if not just to get ready for the next novella that's coming out. So
that's why I wanted to cover your essay, because it is available for people who just want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
Link up. So
on towerofthehand.com, the best website in the world. Anything else, you guys?
No, just let's cross our fingers and hope we appeal on the podcast awards nomination. Like I'm on the ballot.
But Ambassadors of Kingsbury award. I could die happy. Fine.
But you could die happier.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks for everyone who nominated us. And then, talk to me about Summer Hall. Like, I really want to know what people think about Summer Hall. Again, it's something that we've discussed on the podcast, but I don't know that I've had a lot of listener feedback on what they think happened there or any new theories. So I'd be really interested to hear what everyone else thinks.
Amen to that.
Okay. All right. Once again, follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. You can always reach out to us on forums or shoot us an email or make fun of us in our contact box on our website. It's easy to interact with Podcast Device and Fire. And thank you so much for listening. Have a good night, everyone.
See you next time.
Later.
My name's JC Eli. I got into all this first by watching the HBO show, and then I started reading the books about 2 years ago. And really quickly, I realized that these were the most thoroughly enjoyable books I'd ever read, probably in my life. So I went through all of them twice, and then I read the Dunkin' Egg novellas. And after reading The Mystery Knight, I was thinking, damn, I think the Fiddler's gay. So I Googled it just because I was wondering if other people also noticed that. And I stumbled across a podcast of Ice and Fire. So I listened to that episode, and I found myself yelling at the podcast when it got to the part where Kyle was questioning everybody and saying, it's a stretch, the guy's not gay. And I'm thinking, and I'm yelling at the podcast, of course he's gay, it's obvious, it's blatant, the guy's gay. And I was just engaged, and I thought the show was so funny and so hilarious that I listened to it through all of season 3. And over the past couple months, I've been kind of like going through the whole library of podcast shows, and I love it. So I recently joined the forum, and I saw Amin's post about how to be a host on the show. So I figured I would enter my name into consideration just because it would be fun. No matter what, I thought it would be fun to host. And however, whether you put me on or not, I think the show's great, and keep it up.
Okay, so I am recording actually in my room. I'm just going to chill out in my bed and record and see if I can have better acoustics this time.
Cool.
Because normally I record in the living room, and I sound like fucking shit all the time. So how are my acoustics? Are they okay?
Yeah, sounds good. What about me?
Yeah, sounds good.
Good.
So, and also, we only have, 3 people on the call, so should be a lot more manageable. How's it going?
Good. Busy times.
Oh, my God. Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Where's Kyle?
Yeah, it's dialing right now.
Mm.
So, I thought do you want to start with just telling us about the meetup and stuff first, and then we'll move into the essays?
Yeah.
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 Cool.
So, we've got yours. We've got, I guess we have Kyle's talk about his afterword a little bit, And then we've got mine. And like I said, I thought we touched on mine quite a good deal, but...
I have lots of things to say about yours, so good
okay,
things
that's good.
To say about it. Like mine, I don't think there's that much to say about it per se. Like if you have something to say about it, we can say. Otherwise, I'll reveal a couple things I didn't put into it.
Okay.
But I think that's pretty good length.
Yeah, yours is pretty long. I'm still reading it.
Yeah.
Let me try calling Kyle again. What's up, Kyle?
Let's see if he's texting on here or not.
Just some wiki stuff to be ready. Yeah, I was telling Cam, I was like, it's going to be hard because I'm so hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm just going to make myself laugh.
Jeez.
And he does not like that I'm always telling him how funny I am.
Oh, I hear something.
Yo.
What is up?
What's going on, guys? Mimi, why you write so many words? I can't read that fast.
Don't worry about it. They're all pointless. All
right. They're all much bigger than I can comprehend anyway. So
yeah, as someone had pointed out, they were like, you don't have to try so hard to sound intellectual when you're writing. I was like, that's just, I think maybe it comes from writing a lot of academic papers, but.
There you go. I understood not to be fucked with. My recordings are pretty worthless, I think. So I need to adjust all my settings, but I don't have time to figure that out now. But I'll record anyway. Recording.
I'm using Cam's MacBook, so I don't have recording software on this.
All right. So just so you know, I tried to get through this very quickly. So, Mimi, Amin, you're taking the lead.
All right. I wrote a lot down on Mimi, so.
Because I forgot what I wrote as well, so you're going to have to lead me through my MS.
And wait, we're talking about yours again? Haven't we already talked about yours, Amin?
Well, we technically covered mine when you both weren't here, so that's why I'm not expecting that much on mine. Whatever you have, like whatever comments came to mind, you can say it. But
I could have sworn I talked to you about yours.
Well, wasn't that when Amin did his like the game of beds or whatever? Like,
oh yeah, that was the older one.
Yeah. This is the Feast of Vipers one. Yeah.
Oh, I have not read the new one then.
I have mentioned it on the podcast. Like I did, the episode I did for Collector's Edition, I did go with over some other people, but you two weren't there. So, but I was still thinking, like, this is probably going to be, like, 60-40 Mimi's essay, like, at least 60% Mimi's essay, I think.
Ooh.
So.
Well, if we weren't on that episode, then nobody listened to it, so.
Yeah. So the Mimi fan.
Yeah. I was just kidding. Nobody wants to listen to the ones I'm in, so.
Mimi still has the core 3,000 downloads, like, she'll add a plus 3,000 whenever she's on, though, so.
So we're doing episode 122, right?
Yeah, sure. So, yep. I don't know.
We'll release this next week. What's Sunday?
We can just make it up. Sunday is the 20th.
The 20th. Okay.
God, right. I can't believe this month is almost over. Jesus.
I know. Seriously. It feels like just yesterday it was my birthday.
Yeah. Aww.
Okay.
We're going to say we're doing this because the book is on sale this month and this month only, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, I prefer to have a reason to be, self-masturbatory than...
Well, we're not just talking about our essays. We're just talking about the topics we mentioned in our essays. So it's still a Song of Ice and Fire discussion.
Okay.
I get that. Okay. All right. Wait, hold on.
good way to start.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay. All right. Wait, hold on. Okay, so there's a reason why I'm thinking this through right now.
That's a good reason.
Hold on, shut up.
Hey, you with the eardrums. Yeah, I'm talking to you. Still fiending for another fix of nerdy pop culture goodness? Then check out The Vassals of Kingsgrave, the podcast for listeners by listeners, where we discuss everything from A Song of Ice and Fire to the latest movies and TV shows. That's Vassals of Kingsgrave, coming to an iPhone near you.
Bastards of Kingsgrave. The illegitimate offshoot of a podcast of Ice and Fire. Like anime? Like Game of Thrones? Then check out the Bastards of Kingsgrave, the bastard offspring spawned from the aching loins of your two favorite fandoms. Warning, most episodes are PG-25 and contain unexplained references to George R.R. Martin's published A Song of Ice and Fire series.